John, Lee, and Max took the point. Driving the first wagon was Leo Grand and Trest. The guards were Lou Hagen and Bob Grove. On the second wagon were Jack Lightfoot and Gil Lopez. Their guards were Dusty Jordan and a man called Winslow. When they reached the town, John Lee halted the parade and rode in alone, straight up to the marshal's office and sat his horse, staring at Penn Masters and Bam Ford.
Morning. You want something?
I like a by surprise, if you have no objections to my spending money in your town.
No objections at all. How many men are with you?
I have two wagons. Two men to a wagon and two outriders per wagon. My foreman and me.
Your money's good here, John Lee. Oh, and you might want to pay your last respects to Dan Ringgold. He's over yonder at the Undertaker's place. He tried to bushwhack Matt Bodine last night. He didn't make it.
A small, nervous tick appeared under John Lee's left eye. Other than that, he did not change expression.
I didn't even know he left the ranch. What pity. You have enough money on him to bury him?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of cash in his pockets for that. And he done a right nice thing before he passed on. He gave his horse and his rig to Doc Winters. Wasn't that a grand gesture on his part?
Lovely.
John Lee turned his horse and rode back up the street, conscious of the many eyes upon him. He could feel the raw hatred from the onlookers' eyes. Josiah watched from in front of the saloon, standing between Matt and Sam.
He's up to something. And I got a hunch it involves you boys.
It's sort of funny. John Lee thinks that killing me and Sam would solve all his problems. He can't understand that we're just a small part in this play. I wonder why he can't see that.
Because he's nuts. Doctors probably have a better word for it, but I don't know what it is. Nuts is good enough for me.
Look who he's got driving those wagons and acting as outriders.
Matt had picked up on that. John Lee was not using any of his regular hands. The men accompanying him on this day were all top guns.
You can bet that John Lee will stand clear of any action. He's not ready to bet the whole pot just yet.
Lightfoot and Lopez will double team you. That's the way they work. You boys stay together, I'll watch your back.
Sam shifted his eyes to the other end of the street.
Look there. Here comes Vonnie and a few of the hands.
This thing just might get settled today.
I wish. Sam and me have a lot of country to see yet.
You boys sure you don't want to stay in Texas and join the Rangers? We could use you.
I'm not cut out for carrying a badge, and Bodine doesn't have the patience for it.
Josiah smiled as he watched the wagons turn down the alley to the loading dock behind the general store. Josiah liked Matt and Sam. They sort of reminded the Ranger of himself back in his younger days.
I wonder if they'll have a drink and then brace us, or just come straight on with it.
Lightfoot and Lopez stepped out of the store.
There's your answer. John Lee and his foreman have retired to the saloon. They're out of it.
Hagen and Grove appeared in the mouth of the alley and stepped away from each other.
Here it comes. It's double team all the way around, brother.
Vonnie Dodge stood in the center of the street, a street that had suddenly become void of traffic of any kind. The tall, old gunfighter's hands were by his sides, inches away from his guns.
I reckon it's time, boys. Vonnie's closest to Lightfoot, so we'll leave him for Vonnie. I'll take Lopez. Matt, Hagen's yours. Sam, take Grove.
There's four missing. Over there in the store somewhere, or in the alley. Don't forget them when the shooting starts.
Men began moving the last of the horses from the hitch rails to get them out of the line of fire.
You know why we're here, Bodine? Ain't no need pussyfooting around.
You're mine, Lightfoot. Turn and face the man who's about to kill you.
Josiah, Matt, and Sam stepped off the boardwalk and into the street. They stepped away from each other to offer less of a target mass. Lightfoot turned to face Vonnie.
All mouth and nothing to back it up, old man. You should have stayed in your rocking chair, you old coot. Now I'm going to fit you for a pine box.
And do it, punk. Don't just stand there flapping that stupid mouth of yours.
Matt never took his eyes off Lou Hagen. They were the only two men left in the world, and both of them knew the other's reputation. No point in delaying it any longer, Matt thought. He opened the dance. Lou was down on his knees, clawing at his pistol, disbelief in his eyes at Bodine's speed. Matt shot him again, the slug striking him in the center of his chest and finishing it for Lou Hagen. Bonnie's body spat fire and lead and smoke, and Lightfoot sat down in the center of the street. Bob Grove was down, the front of his shirt bloody. Sam shot him again, and the gun fell from his fingers. Gil Lopez was down on his butt in the dirt, gut shot twice by Josiah. He lifted his .45 and eared back the hammer. Josiah put another round in him.
No. No.
Yeah. It ain't supposed to happen to you, is it, Gil?
No. I shall not die on this day.
I wouldn't put no bets on it.
I want a priest.
How about a Baptist preacher, amigo?
Are you serious?
Leo Grand stepped out of an alley and took aim through the swirling gun smoke. He put a round into Josiah, the slug knocking the Texas Ranger down. Matt shot him 4 times. Leo was dead before he hit the dirt. The Oklahoma gunfighter, Trest, stepped over Leo's body. By God, I'll end it. Matt, Bonnie, Sam, and Josiah all fired at once. Trest's boots flew out from under him, and he landed on his rear, his back to a building, his guns by his side.
Get them other two! It's just my leg, go on!
But Winslow and Dusty Jordan, seeing how the battle was going, had ducked into the saloon through the back door and were sitting with John Lee and his foreman when the men slammed open the bat wings and stepped inside. Max lifted a mug of beer in a mock salute.
Quite a show, boys. You put that on for our benefit?
Yes, very entertaining indeed.
How about it, John? You and me in the street, face to face, fastest gun hand walks off.
John Lee would not meet the old foreman's eyes. He stared into his beer mug.
Stand up and fight, you yeller-bellied bastard!
John Lee sat his chair.
Scum. Stinking no-count yeller pile of horseshit. That's all you are, John Lee. You have to hire your fighting done. You ain't man enough to do it yourself.
Max pushed back his chair and slowly stood up.
You'll not talk to John Lee like that in my presence.
Well then, you'll just have to do.
Oh! Max swayed on his feet for a moment, feeling the hot stickiness running down his chest, his life's blood ebbing from him.
But you're old.
Vonnie twirled his peacemaker and settled it back into leather.
No, I'm just good, Max.
Max tried to lift his pistol out of leather. It gave up. It was just too much effort. His legs could no longer support him. Then he sat down in his chair and looked at John Lee. His face was very pale.
I reckon I'm dead, boss.
Max slowly put his head on the table and closed his eyes. His hat fell off and hit the floor. Winslow, hat in hand, cautiously approached.
I expect our supplies is loaded by now, boss. We best be getting on back.
Yes. Please, remove Max from this place. Put him in a wagon. Do it gently. He's been with me for many years.
John Lee stood up, moving like a man in severe pain. He looked at Monty, opened his mouth to speak, then closed it. He shook his head and walked toward the bat wings.
Have a shooting iron in your hand next time I see you, John Lee. Either that, or leave this part of Texas.
John Lee turned slowly.
You dare to give me orders?
Yeah, I'm giving you orders. I'll not kill you now. I reckon even a man like you is capable of feeling grief. I'll let you put Max in the ground and get drunk a night or two. After that, get gone, or face me.
You!
Winslow quickly dropped Max's feet and grabbed his boss by the arm.
Not now, boss, not now.
Yes, I shouldn't respond to anything this rabble has to say. You're quite right, What is your name?
Winslow, boss.
Certainly. I knew that. It's a sock, I suppose. Come on.
He pushed open the bat wings and walked out.
It's just about over.
Bam Ford and Penn had been about 2 miles from town when the shooting started and had just entered the bat wings in time to see Max get his long overdue comeuppance.
It will be next time I see John Lee, even if he's standing alongside God.
John Lee buried his friend, his only friend, and then retired to his grand house, sitting on the front porch, drinking not whiskey, but coffee. Nick, his behind resting on several thick pillows, sat with him.
When do you think you'll be able to ride, boy?
Another week or 10 days, Papa. We gonna attack the town?
No. We're moving out. Heading west to start over. I could go on and fight for the next year, and all I'd be doing is spending money.
Where are we going, Papa?
Montana, maybe? Wyoming? I don't know. Someplace away from here.
Nick shook his head.
What's the matter?
I was born right here, Papa. Not in this house, but on this land. It's ours. I ain't leaving. Look, Bodine and Sam and the Ranger can't stay here forever. They're drifters. We just lie low for a time and they'll move on. We'll rebuild our crew and in a month or 6 months or a year, we'll hit that damn town so hard they'll not know what happened to them. Then it'll be right back the way it was for all these outsiders to come in and screw it all up.
It'll never be the way it was, boy. Get that notion out of your head. I'm under a death sentence put on me by Bonnie Dodge. You've got years ahead of you. You've got to live, you and Cindy and the child. Cindy can't stand no long trail drive, but she could be taken to Fort Worth and looked after there. You go with her. You're not in good enough health to help me in what I got to do. I'll arrange for the drovers to move the herd, and then when you and Cindy are able, you come on following. You and me, we'll plan tonight where we start over. I've had my say, boy. That's the way it's going to be. Now leave me for a time.
After his son had gone back into the house, John Lee warmed his coffee and set about cleaning his guns. No man talked to him the way Vonnie Dodge talked to him that day and lived. When all the plans were firm and the drovers moving the herd and the boy and Cindy were in the buggy and gone, John Lee would gather his fighting men and seek his revenge. That was the way it had to be. Vonnie Dodge had thrown down the challenge, and John Lee had to pick it up. That was the code. John Lee called for one of his few working hands to come to him.
Rise for the settlement, Winslow. Start passing the word that I want drovers. We're moving the herd. Get them back here as soon as possible.
Right, boss, I'm gone.
John Lee's eyes were bleak as he stared out over his land.
A week, Vonnie. 10 days, maybe. And one of us is dead.
Josiah was sitting at a table in the saloon with Matt and Sam, his wounded leg propped up on a chair, when Penn joined them.
Stage driver just told me that John Lee's hiring drovers.
Drovers or gun hands?
Cowboys. John Lee's gonna move the herd. Cindy's done pulled out for Fort Worth in a fancy buggy, and Nick is supposed to follow her pretty quick.
The stage driver was full of information, wasn't he?
Bam entered the saloon. He'd been out chasing a horse thief for the better part of 2 days. He ordered a beer and sat down wearily.
You catch him?
I caught him. He pulled iron. I shot him. Planted him this morning. Lots of news out on the trail. John Lee's moving his herd to Montana by way of Kansas. He's planning to sell most of his beeves to the army and take the best north for breeding stock. He's going to start the herd in a couple of days.
I can't believe he's given up.
He ain't. I run into Rogers on the trail. He left the Broken Lance. Said John Lee seemed like he was going to pull something wild. He doesn't know what, but he said some of the boys is talking about hitting the town and looting it and setting it on fire. And John Lee is all the time talking about killing Vonnie Dodge.
John's good with a gun. Don't sell him short on that. I don't know whether he's as good as Vonnie. I doubt it. But the man is no coward.
Nick won't last in Montana. He'll be dead within 6 months. Takes some doing to live up there.
I agree. If the weather doesn't kill him, some cowboy will. And it's my opinion that Cindy will never leave Fort Worth. She isn't cut out for homesteading in Montana. You think Jeff Sparks and Vonnie know about this move?
Oh, yeah. Rogers told me that Circle S and Flying V punchers are watching every move the Broken Lance boys make. John Lee's still got about 30 or 35 randy old boys with him. They could hurt this town, for a fact. They'll not tree it, but they could do enough damage so's it might not recover from it. We got to think about that.
And stay close.
Yeah. Here comes Jeff and some of his crew now.
The owner of the Circle S pulled a table close to the men, and he and Vonnie and Jean sat down ordering beer. The other hands with him went to the bar.
You men heard the news about John Lee?
That's what we were just talking about. What do you make of it?
The rancher sipped his beer and looked thoughtful for a moment.
I think that John Lee has sent his stupid kid and equally stupid wife out of harm's way. I think he's going to throw the dice for the jackpot or bust.
A suicide raid?
Exactly.
I hadn't thought of that, but you just may be right.
He's gone round the bend. I think he knows it. He's chosen this way to go out, rather than be placed in some institution for the feeble-minded.
Then he's doubly dangerous. You can usually predict what a normal person will do. There is no way of telling what a crazy man might do.
Especially one who is on a suicide mission.
So what do we do?
Wait. There ain't nothing else we can do except warn the townspeople to get ready.
The town made ready without being obvious about it. Every water barrel that could be found was filled, and buckets and pails were stashed close by in the event of fire. The manager of the general store sold out of 44s and 45s and had to reorder. But everyone knew by the time the reordered ammo arrived, their fates would have been long settled. Men were assigned positions from which to fire. Women knew where to go with their kids from any part of town. Anyone handy with a hammer and saw was busy building thick shutters with gun slits to close and cover their windows in the hope that while the wall sure wouldn't stop a bullet, the shutters might. One bright, hot morning, one of Noah's hands came fogging into town and jumped down in front of the marshal's office.
The drovers have started the Broken Lance herd north. One of Jeff Sparks' spies he sent down to the settlement come back last night saying that John Lee's men done bought every box of bullets in town.
Nick Lee?
Gone. He pulled out yesterday in a buggy. I think we done seen the last of that squirt.
Don't bet on it.
I tend to agree with you, Josiah.
Sam noticed the badge was once more pinned to Josiah's shirt.
I asked to come off leave, since it's all up to John Lee now. I'll be sure to arrest any survivors of the raid.
Here's the plan from our end of it.
The flying V-hand laid it all out. The town shut down early that night. By the time the sun had vanished over the horizon and the evening shadows began cooling the land, most of the townspeople had eaten their supper and turned out the lamps. The men would stand two-hour watches through the night, thus ensuring that everyone would get enough rest while still maintaining a tight vigil over the town. At 4 o'clock, all the men of the town were in their assigned positions and waiting for the attack.
If my addition is correct, I figured John Lee's got 35 men, counting himself.
Add about 10 or 15 more to that. His regular hands will probably come in too.
I completely forgot about them. You're right. If John Lee fails this day, those men would have a tough time finding work anywhere in Texas. It's do or die for them too.
Matt looked up and down the street. He knew that everybody was up, but as instructed, no lamps were lit. The town appeared to be sleeping in the pre-dawn hours. Vonnie joined them, the old gunfighter standing tall and straight and ready.
We got about an hour before dawn. Time for a biscuit, one more cup of coffee, and a smoke. I'll do that and get it in position. Good luck to you, boys. Keep your wits about you. Like we used to say up in the mountains. And keep your powder dry.
He walked off into the darkness.
Coffee's ready. And the cook at the cafe sent over some donuts. You can't beat a breakfast like that.
The men poured coffee and grabbed up the donuts, still warm and sprinkled with sugar. John Lee and his men struck the town hard, just as dawn was busting the darkness. They had walked their horses in close, then mounted up and charged, several of the raiders carrying lighted torches to fire the town. Those men were the first to die, for the townspeople knew that if one or two of the closely built buildings were to catch fire, the entire town would go. One house was fired, but the women quickly formed a bucket brigade and caught the flames before they could do anything except very minor damage. The raiders all wore long dusters and masks over their faces, their hats pulled down low. It was impossible to tell one from another. One raider charged out of the alley between the general store and the cafe and rode his horse up onto the boardwalk. Matt blew him out of the saddle and slapped the frightened horse on the rump, sending it racing riderless up the street to the edge of town. two raiders came riding straight up the street, guns blazing. Mac, Sam, Bam, and Pin fired as one, and two more horses lost their riders. The hired guns lay motionless in the dirt. Dusty Jordan was shot off his horse by Pen Masters. Bam put a slug into Winslow just as the outlaw put the spurs to his horse. The horse jumped, and Winslow lost his balance, tumbling from the saddle. He landed head first in a horse trough, knocking himself out and drowned. The townspeople, once all the outlaws were inside the town, rolled wagons across the road and many of the alleyways, containing the raiders. Dave Land, seeing that any escape by horseback was blocked, jumped from the saddle and ran into the church. Reverend Willoughby met him with a rifle. Dean Waters tried to jump a wagon. His horse, smarter than the rider, refused, and Dean went flying, butt over elbows. He cleared the wagon and hit the ground on the other side. A woman stepped out of her quarters and conked him on the head with a poker, then hit him again for insurance. Jack Morgan came face to face with Matt Bodine, and Matt laid a .44 across the man's face twice, breaking his jaw and knocking him out. Riggs exited his saddle and tried to make a run for the alley. Chucky's rifle barked, and Riggs fell like a rag doll to lie still in the street. Pate ran into the guns of Barlow and Gilly, the slugs turning him around and around in the street. Wheeler came nose to nose with Parnell, and the Circle S Cowboys 45s belched fire and flame. Wheeler sat down on the ground and quietly expired. Matt spotted John Lee. The man was standing alone, his guns in leather, his hands by his side.
Don't let it end this way, John Lee. You're a sick man. Maybe the doctors can help you. I won't draw on you. Come on. It's over. Give it up, John.
Kill me.
Matt noticed Sam quietly slipping up behind the man.
No. I won't shoot you. You're a sick man.
Then I'll kill you.
Sam laid the barrel of his .44 across the back of John Lee's head. The rancher crumpled to the ground. Of the 19 hired guns that surrendered, 12 survived the day and night, the others dying of their wounds. Two more died the following day. The local undertaker did his best to keep the smile off his face. When the rangers arrived to take the men off for trial, it was a state case now, something about conspiracy and the shooting of a Texas Ranger and about 24 other charges. Ranger headquarters decided to come in force. They sent two men. John Lee was a babbling, broken man. He was in chains, not so much to keep him from hurting other people as to keep him from hurting himself. His herd had been stopped in New Mexico and turned back. There was going to be a lot of settling up, and the herd was impounded until everything was over. Josiah told Noah Carson and Jeff Sparks to look after the herd and don't let nothing happen to it. It was said with a smile and received with one. Someone set the John Lee Mansion on fire a couple of nights after the battle in Namath. The mansion, the bunkhouse, and all the other buildings burned slap to the ground. But the Rangers never did find the safe that was in John Lee's study, and Nick just dropped out of sight, flat disappeared, without his wife. Cindy, it was later reported, was taken in by some of Nick's mother's people over in Louisiana. No one who lived west of the Pecos ever saw her again. Vonnie and Conchita got married. So did Lisa and Noah. Leah was busy casting her charms for Doc Winters. Odds were he'd take the bait before long. Jean took to Sparkin, the daughter of a rancher, and he was in love, walking into walls and falling off his horse and everything else that went with it. Pen Masters and Bam Ford joined up with the Texas Rangers. At the crossroads, Josiah Finch sat horse and looked at Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves.
Well, boys, where are you off to this time?
We'll drift. See some country. We might run into you again.
The ranger shook hands with them both.
Boys, you can say you've been to hell and you can say you've been to Texas. Which one do you prefer?
Hell. Yeah!
Josiah chased them both for about a mile, but with a big grin all the time, knowing it was all in fun. The last he saw of Matt and Sam, for this go-round, was the Blood Brothers on the crest of a small rise, hats in their hands, waving them.
Texas, by God!
Blood Bond, Gunsight Crossing is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1990, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, James Konacek, Jeff Baker, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Michael Replogle, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Elliot Dash, Sonny Lasky, Ariane Parker, Tim Carlin, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Nathaniel Perry, Johan Detweiler, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Johan Detweiler. Additional original music by Brian Patton and Johan Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. If you enjoyed Blood Bond, be sure to look for the Eagles series and The First Mountain Man, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator, by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 8, Drivers of the Purple Rage.
When Bud gave Mark Dalton his choice of Lowe's, he decided on the one headed for the East Coast. Even though it was one of the biggest ports on the east coast of North America, Halifax was one of the few parts of the country he'd never been to. Given the choice between a reefer of beef headed for Montreal, a flatbed laden with machine equipment bound for Sudbury that would have to be buttoned down every 100 kilometers, and a van trailer full of plastic pool toys made in China and destined for Halifax, the decision was an easy one to make. The lighter cargo would be easier on motherload, and since it wasn't due into the warehouse in Halifax for 3 days, he could take his time with it. Hopefully, the trip would be an uneventful one, which would be a welcome change after the events of the past few months. On his last trip to the West Coast and back, he'd helped a fellow trucker get untangled from a bunch of smugglers, got caught up in an insurance scam, got ripped off on some routine truck repairs, almost got killed working on a movie set, helped a friend keep his rig, and spent 2 hellish days as a dispatcher. That would have been enough excitement to last a lifetime for most truckers, but Mark seemed to have a talent for finding trouble. Or perhaps trouble had a way of finding its way to him, sort of like an old dog always being able to find its master. Whatever the reason for it, Mark was looking forward to a leisurely drive to the coast, maybe a day on the beach in Lawrencetown trying out a surfboard, and then a load out of the port heading west. The future looked comfortable. Peaceful. Just then, an older model Chrysler New Yorker cut in front of him, trying to squeeze into the lane to get around a Suburban pulling a trailer in the left-hand lane. Mark had to jam on the brakes to avoid hitting the Chrysler, and the light load gave the trailer's tires no real grip on the asphalt. The rear wheels locked up and his rig hardly slowed at all.
Shit, shit, shit!
Mark turned the wheel right to keep his front bumper from being clipped by the speeding car. The right front tire of his Peterbilt caught the shoulder and he started sliding to the right over the gravel and dirt on the side of the highway. The Chrysler straightened out, sped past the Suburban, and turned back into the passing lane, causing the driver of that vehicle to slam on his brakes and veer into the lane in front of Mark. Again, Mark had to turn the wheel sharply to avoid a collision. Behind him, the trailer swung wildly out across the highway, and then mercifully straightened out.
Crazy son of a bitch!
By now, Mark was traveling slowly, and all the other vehicles around him were traveling less than 70. He downshifted a few times to find the right gear, then began the long, slow climb back up the gears to get his rig back up to speed. The Chrysler was about a half a kilometer up the highway, driving slightly slower now since it didn't have to weave and swerve through traffic. As Mark passed the Suburban, he could see the driver wiping his brow with a handkerchief, and the woman in the passenger seat jawing a blue streak as she pointed an accusatory finger at the Chrysler down the road. Mark was angry at the driver, too. After all, he could have killed somebody.
Well, you're not going to get away with that, Sonny.
He was up past 110 now, and he could probably get it up to 120 and cruise along at that speed for hours. Even if he didn't catch up to the Chrysler, he might be able to stay behind it, looming large in his mirrors so the driver would know that what he'd done was not only wrong, but downright dangerous. As the speedometer flirted with 120, the blue and white welcome sign for Kingston zoomed past on Mark's right. At this rate, he'd be through Brockville and Cornwall in just a few hours, and would likely reach Halifax much earlier than expected. More importantly, he was getting closer to the bastard in the Chrysler. Another few kilometers and he'd be on him, right up his rear end, giving him a little taste of his own medicine. Outside of Brockville, Mark had managed to pull directly behind the Chrysler. When he got up close to the 10-year-old burgundy sedan, he was able to read the vanity plate below the trunk lid, Big SHT. Mark wondered what was supposed to go between the H and the T. It was either an O or an I. The driver probably thought O, but Mark was convinced it was I. When the front of his Peterbilt was just a few feet from the rear bumper of the Chrysler, Mark let the driver have a blast from his horn. The sound must have startled the driver because the Buick suddenly swerved like a snake slithering down the road.
How do you like that?
The driver of the Chrysler rolled down his window and gave Mark the bird. Mark saw the man's middle finger waving in the air and tightened his grip on the steering wheel until his knuckles turned white. He could feel his face getting hot and red, and his body was a tightly packed ball of rage and in danger of exploding. The driver pulled over as if to let Mark by, but Mark wasn't having any of it. He pulled into the right-hand lane behind the car and kept his foot down hard on the accelerator. The driver was obviously tired of the high-speed chase and moved left to let Mark by.
You're not getting off that easy, asswipe.
Again, Mark pulled behind him, pushing the guy along with his huge rig, forcing him to keep up the pace, even if he had enough of playing cat and mouse. The driver moved into the right-hand lane again, but this time he tried slowing down so that he could get behind Mark and hopefully be done with it. But Mark wouldn't let him. He began inching over to the right, cutting off the lane and leaving the other driver with no place to go. The driver was forced onto the shoulder, just like Mark had been forced to do an hour earlier. Dirt, gravel, and dust rose up in a plume behind the car, and the driver had to struggle to keep the swerving car under control.
Yeah, how's that for you, buddy?
And then the car jammed on its brakes and began skidding to a stop. It was gone from the lane and had fallen far behind Mark's rig. Mark reveled in his victory. He'd shown that guy in the Chrysler a thing or two, and he doubted if he'd go speeding down the 401 again anytime soon. He raised the middle finger of his right hand, knowing full well the driver would never see it.
I'm number one, pal.
Just then, Mark saw a minivan in the lane ahead of him. He was still moving as quickly as his rig could go, and the minivan was cruising along, probably just under the speed limit. Mark took his foot off the accelerator and started downshifting, but it wasn't going to be enough. He jammed on the brakes and struggled to keep the front of his Peterbilt from slamming into the back of the tiny vehicle in front of him. The back tires cried out in pain and torment as they tried to get a grip on the highway, and the trailer began to slide out to the left, sweeping across the passing lane like an arm clearing off a tabletop. There was another car in the lane, a tiny Geo Metro that would probably be destroyed if it came into even the slightest contact with the trailer. And suddenly it was over. The trailer straightened out, the wheels unlocked, and he was rumbling along at 95. There were kids in the back of the minivan. They waved to him. Mark waved back. There was a young girl riding in the Metro. She was talking to the young guy behind the wheel, a boyfriend or fiancé, as if she didn't have a clue about how close she'd just been to being killed. Killed by a maniac road rager named Mark Dalton. How many times had he read about road rage and felt he was too much of a professional to ever become caught up in the heat of the moment? How many times had he shook his head after reading about some bizarre account of some experienced driver losing it out on the highway? How many times had he said he was above all that? Countless times. But in the end, he wasn't immune to it. He'd fallen victim to it, just like all the others, and nearly killed a few innocent people in the process.
Never again. It's not worth it.
He looked in his rearview mirror for the Chrysler, thinking maybe he could apologize to the driver. but the car was little more than a tiny speck in the mirrors now.
Keeping a safe distance, huh? And I don't blame you.
Mark focused on the road ahead, brought his rig up to 105 and switched on the cruise control, suddenly content to let the rest of the world pass him by. Between Brockville and Cornwall, the highway had been fairly quiet. Up ahead, in the lane in front of him, Mark saw an empty lowboy that he seemed to be reeling in at a pretty good clip. He hadn't had to pass anyone for a while, and he wasn't keen on doing it now since he was in no real hurry. But this rig was moving too slowly for him to follow for any length of time. Mark checked his mirrors, saw there wasn't anyone racing up the left lane, and pulled out to pass. He was creeping past the lowboy slowly, almost making him wonder why he was even bothering to pass the guy. But it soon became obvious that the guy had sped up while Mark was trying to pass him. Mark knew plenty of drivers who hated being passed by other truckers, especially when they were pulling a light load and some big tanker roared on because of some big horsepower advantage. Maybe this guy was like that, although it wasn't likely since Mark wasn't hauling anything but puffed up plastic and foam and the guy's trailer was empty. After about 20 seconds, Mark was still trying to get by, inching up the lowboy as if his fingers were walking along the trailer to mark his progress. He pressed the accelerator down hesitantly, not wanting to get caught up in another situation like the one he had earlier in the day. At last, he was even with the other trucker's cab. He looked over at the man and waved hello. The other driver had only been periodically glancing to his left, but when Mark gave him a wave, he immediately put his eyes on the road in front of him and kept them there.
And a good day to you too, buddy.
Finally, he was past the lowboy and was just waiting for his trailer to clear it so he could move back into the right-hand lane when he noticed a road crew working in the passing lane up ahead. One of their trucks was halfway out into the lane, and a few orange cones were lined up on the shoulder. Mark checked his mirror and saw the other driver was still trying to match his speed, as if he wanted Mark to work damn hard to pass him. Well, Mark was working. In fact, he was sweating now. He had two choices. He could either hit the road crew's truck, or he could cut off the lowboy and hope the two trucks didn't touch. He decided on the latter, since it was the only one in which it might be possible for everyone to get through it without a scratch. He floored the accelerator and waited for the last possible moment, then pulled right. He missed the rear end of the road crew's truck, which had now pulled completely onto the shoulder, and he managed to get far enough in front of the lowboy so that at worst, the other driver would have to slam on his brakes.
Sorry.
Mark looked into his mirrors. The lowboy was sending up a cloud of black smoke, and the trailer seemed to be shuddering on the asphalt. The rig began to grow smaller in his mirrors as the driver pulled over onto the side of the highway.
This is motherlode to the fella in the lowboy. Do you copy? Maybe we'll meet up somewhere down the road.
The lowboy had become a tiny speck in his mirrors now, but he could still make out the plume of smoke rising up from its stack as the rig got up some speed and prepared to rejoin traffic. But as the minutes passed, it became apparent that the lowboy wasn't just getting back into the highway's flow. He was making some serious steam trying to catch back up to Mark. With each kilometer that passed, the white early model Volvo with a rhubarb across the front of its grille grew larger and larger in his mirrors. He guessed it was around 10 years old, probably with more than a few million kilometers on it. It was obvious the rig wasn't going to win any races, but Mark wasn't in the mood for driving like a maniac. After all, he'd been there and done that just that morning, and that had been enough excitement, even for Mark. But the lowboy just kept on coming. Mark saw a sign for a rest station coming up in another 2 kilometers and figured it was about time for a break. Sitting down with a meal and a newspaper might do him some good, and it might also give the guy in the lowboy a chance to cool off. He pulled right onto the off-ramp and slowed his rig. He brought it around back and parked it so that he would be able to see it from several of the picnic tables set up outside the rest station. As he walked toward the main building, Mark noticed that the lowboy had also pulled in and had parked in one of the few open spots at the opposite end of the lot from Motherlode. He watched the rig for a long time, waiting for the man to get out and approach him, but he never did.
Well, at least he's not looking for a confrontation.
He used the restroom, ordered a burger, fries, and coffee, and then bought a copy of the National Post to read while he ate. He was halfway through the sports section by the time he finished eating and carried his coffee with him back to his rig. As far as he could tell, the lowboy driver hadn't come into the rest station, and maybe hadn't even left his rig. Perhaps he was tired and needed to catch a few winks. Hopefully, that would explain his erratic driving. Sure, the guy had spent most of the day driving to deliver whatever equipment he was carrying, and now that he was returning home, he was beat, just trying to put a few more kilometers under the wheels before taking a break. That was probably it, had to be. It sure beat thinking that he'd tried to get Mark killed after Mark had cut him off through no fault of his own. Mark paused a moment in the parking lot. Maybe he should go over and knock on the guy's cab and explain what happened. He could tell him he was sorry and that he hadn't meant to send him off the road. Then again, the guy might be sleeping by now, dreaming of someone like Shannon Tweed, and Mark waking him wasn't going to make matters any better. Might even piss him off. But if Mark left now, the guy would be sleeping for another few hours, and by the time he woke up, Mark would be halfway to Halifax. That made the most sense. They were both professionals, after all. Best to just let it go. Water under the bridge, or more appropriately, asphalt under the tires. And they could both get on with the job of delivering goods and making themselves a living, while making sure stuff like that didn't happen again. Satisfied with his decision, Mark took a sip of his coffee and headed for his rig. In moments, he was underway. As he cleared his trailer of the other rigs parked in the lot, he noticed movement in his mirror. Apparently, Lowboy was on the move too. By the time Mark neared the Ontario-Quebec border, it was obvious that the driver of the Lowboy was following him. He had matched Mark's pace every kilometer of the way, even passing other vehicles when it was unsafe to do so just to stay behind him. Mark wondered if he should radio for help, or perhaps try to reach the Ontario Provincial Police to report. Report what? That some driver was following him on the highway, driving just as fast as he was, no more or no less? There was no law against following another trucker. Hell, Mark did it himself often enough when he was tired and the guy in front of him was doing a decent enough pace. But this guy wasn't just following him, he was keeping Mark close to him, like he hadn't forgotten about being cut off by Mark back near Brockville.
Man, he must really be pissed off.
Mark upped his speed to 110, hoping to catch the other driver by surprise and see him fade into the distance. No chance. The guy was accelerating as well, keeping between one and two truck lengths behind him. It was a crazy situation, sort of like that famous TV movie Duel that starred Dennis Weaver as some sad sack salesman being pursued across the California desert by a crazed trucker driving a big tank trailer, presumably filled with oil. But that was a movie. This, on the other hand, was the real thing, and in real life, people could get hurt. Maybe Mark, maybe the other driver, but just maybe some two-year-old whose parents were driving to Montreal to visit Nana and Opa. Mark shook his head at the thought. He couldn't keep driving all day without a break. Neither of them could. But it didn't look as if the other driver was going to back down any, so it was up to Mark to do something. He decided the best thing would be to get away from the guy before he had the chance to do something crazy. Mark pressed his foot down hard on the accelerator. He heard the Cummins lag behind for a moment, then thrum at a higher pitch. Soon, the entire rig was gaining speed and the speedometer slowly began to acknowledge he was accelerating. 115, 116, 118. Mark checked his mirrors and saw that the rhubarb on the front of the Volvo tractor wasn't getting any smaller, but actually loomed even larger in his mirrors, like the crazy fool was actually gaining on him. Mark kept accelerating, pulling out into the passing lane to glide by a pickup truck fully loaded with furniture and appliances. 120 now. The Lowboy was getting even closer, as if the guy was willing to burn out his motor just to give Mark a scare.
Well, I am scared. Scared that somebody's gonna get killed and the event will end up on one of those road rage websites for all my fellow truckers to see.
When he was down to just over 100, he brought his foot down again and began feeding fuel into the engine. Then he pulled over into the passing lane, giving the Lowboy behind him plenty of opportunity to get by. But the Lowboy slowed as well, staying in the right-hand lane as if he were minding his manners and had no business getting out in front of Mark. Cars were beginning to back up in both lanes behind them. Surely a cop would soon be on to them, and then Mark would be the one at fault. Mark pulled back into the right lane and brought Motherlode back up to a comfortable speed.
Damn it!
Even though the guy hadn't done a damn thing to him, his mere presence was incredibly annoying, and if nothing else, it was diverting Mark's attention away from the road. This had to be the opposite of road rage, Mark thought. Road unrage, he should call it, where a driver is driving erratically to avoid a nasty confrontation, but without any luck. He had a long way to go before he got to Halifax, and if this guy hounded him the entire way, he'd be a nervous wreck by the time it came for him to deliver his load and interact with a shipper.
All right, I've had enough.
He decided it was time he reported this guy to the police. Regardless of what his intentions were, the Lowboy driver had put people's lives at risk by trying to stay behind Mark at all costs. Even if the police didn't do anything, at least the guy would know Mark wasn't about to let him get away with trying to scare him half to death.
This is a 911, Ontario Provincial Police. Do you copy?
No answer. In fact, Judging by the lack of static coming from the box, Mark couldn't even be sure his radio was working.
Can I have a radio check, please? Son of a bitch.
He realized the guy had probably disabled his radio at the last rest station. This was getting serious, and Mark was getting nervous. He could pull over and stop, but that would just give the guy the chance to pick a fight with him in the middle of nowhere. Besides, it was recommended that you drive to a police station or a public place, or if at night, someplace where there was plenty of light. Well, it was the middle of the day and there wasn't a police station in sight. Up ahead, there was a sign for another rest station. Excellent. Mark would pull in, park his rig, and try to talk some sense to the guy. He'd apologize, buy the guy lunch, anything, just so that it could be over and they could both be on their way. And not only that, but a bathroom break after all the excitement on the road wouldn't be a bad idea either. A second sign appeared at the side of the highway, and Mark knew that one way or another, this whole thing would be over in just a few minutes. Mark slowed and signaled to exit the highway. He checked his mirrors and saw that the lowboy wasn't signaling at all. He wasn't even slowing down. Mark watched closely as the lowboy continued on past the rest station and on down the highway. He was gone.
Thank God that's over with.
Mark made use of the facilities inside the rest station, and then wondered if he should pick up a coffee and something to go. A coffee would be great, and there was a Tim Hortons in the rest station, which was his favorite. But there was something about coffee and long hauls that just didn't mix. If he had another coffee now, he'd be stopping at every rest stop between here and Halifax. No thanks. But even though he didn't want a coffee, he wasn't keen on heading back onto the highway just yet either. He wanted to give the lowboy as much time alone on the highway as he could. With any luck, someone else might cut him off or wave hello or just get on the guy's nerves. Admittedly, it wasn't much of a plan, but Mark wasn't sure there was a solution to this particular problem. Lowboy was obviously crazy. Either that or road raged. Mark decided on an apple fritter that would keep his stomach happy until dinner time, and he ate it in silence while he watched the traffic zoom by along the highway outside the window. The trucks passed by at random, and it was a lot like a lottery, really. Any one of those drivers could snap at any moment, and when it happened, years of experience, professionalism, and just plain common sense would all get tossed out the window. It was a lottery, all right, but one in which there was no winners and way too many losers. He finished his fritter and headed back out to his rig. Before he got underway, Mark checked his radio and antenna, hoping he might be able to repair them. No such luck. Not only had Lowboy cut several of his wires, he had cut entire sections out of the wires, leaving Mark with a bunch of naked ends that were too short to be reconnected. Mark could feel the anger gathering within him, a hot pot about to boil, and did his best to remain calm. Sure, he was pissed off, but it wasn't going to do him any good to charge out of the rest station looking for blood. He could get the radio fixed easily enough, and if he needed to, he could always dial 911 on his cell phone. Reluctantly, Mark climbed into Motherlode, started her up, and headed back onto the highway. About 5 kilometers out of the rest station, Mark saw a rig up ahead parked on the shoulder.
Oh, come on!
As he neared, it became obvious that the rig pulled over onto the side of the highway was none other than the lowboy being pulled by the rhubarb Volvo.
Doesn't this guy ever give up?
He tried to take a quick look into the cab as he went by, but the light was wrong, and he couldn't make out anyone in either of the front seats. For a moment, he thought that maybe the guy was taking a nap, but he'd wrongly assumed that once already, and he knew in his heart that all the guy had been doing there was waiting for Mark to pass. And sure enough, before Mark was even 100 meters down the highway, the Volvo's twin stacks belched a cloud of smoke, and the lowboy was signaling a return to the highway. Mark wasn't sure how long he could go on like this. Up ahead on the right-hand side of the highway, a pair of yellow lights were flashing atop a large rectangular sign, beckoning drivers to pull over and drive through the weigh scales.
Yes.
Mark usually didn't have much affection for the inspectors who man the coupes, but right now they seemed heaven sent. However, as much as Mark wanted to be stopped for an inspection, his cargo was very light, and he was well below his gross vehicle weight limit of 80,000 pounds. And even though Motherlode was a 6-year-old Peterbilt 379, he always kept her in top condition, so there would be no obvious reason for the inspectors to pull him over.
Just my luck.
He'd be through the station in seconds, and then he and Lowboy would be back on the highway just a kilometer down the road from where they left off. Mark had to think of something, and quick. And then he was struck with an idea. He reached over and got out his logbook. then took out a large black magic marker from the visor above him and quickly scribbled a message onto the back cover of the book. Then, as he slowed down to drive over the scales, he reached over and pressed the logbook up against the passenger window. Hopefully, he was moving slowly enough, and at least one of the inspectors was attentive enough to read the message. Mark watched closely as an inspector sipping a cup of coffee squinted in Mark's direction as he drove by. At first, the man expressed surprise. Then, he quickly put down his coffee and nodded at Mark. Mark slid back into the driver's seat and began shifting up through the gears, preparing for his return to highway traffic. At the same time, he kept an eye in his mirrors, watching all of the inspectors scramble out of the coupe and flag down Lowboy before he had a chance to drive through the scales. Lowboy came to a stop, probably wondering what the hell was going on. And then, before fixing his eyes on the road in front of him, Mark glanced over at the logbook that was now on the passenger seat and read the message he'd hurriedly scribbled onto the book's back cover. Lowboy behind, wielding gun. His penmanship was a bit sloppy, and he'd almost made the letters too big to fit onto the back of the book, but judging by the result, the four words had done their job. Maybe he had a gun, maybe he didn't. Either way, by the time the inspectors had it all figured out, Mark would be hundreds of kilometers away and driving in peace.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.